You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, the Russian aid convoy inches closer to Ukraine amid fears it's a front for military action. Our guests Daniela Pellet and Mary Dachevsky discuss whether Putin's planning to pull the wool over people's eyes. We'll also look at Iraq and the ongoing humanitarian crisis. Also, going gaga for good tunes, the Frenchman who has launched a radio station for babies.
The babies, I think, can appreciate any kind of music. So I play children music as lullabies and children's songs, but it's not even half of the music we played.
And the book that gives us the final word on celebrated German director Werner Herzog and two other book recommendations for this week. That is all coming up on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Suzanne Gislett with the latest news.
An international mission to evacuate Iraqi civilians trapped on a mountain by Islamist insurgents has been abandoned after American personnel found far fewer people still stranded. The Pentagon says a team of military and humanitarian workers sent to Mount Sinjar found only a few thousand people, as opposed to the 30,000 or so that had been previously thought to be trapped without food or water. In the past few moments, Barack Obama has praised the efforts of all those involved in aid drops to help the refugees and said most of the American military personnel involved will now leave Iraq. The British Prime Minister David Cameron, who had moved military assets to the region to help with any humanitarian efforts, has welcomed the news.
We have to respond to the situation as it develops, and we need to make sure we have good information about how many people there are, how many need to leave, how well they can get to a place of safety, and our plans have got to be flexible enough to help those people, working with allies like the Kurds, to make sure we can help people in need.
The United Nations says there is still a humanitarian crisis in northern Iraq, as many people fleeing from Islamic State fighters are now in refugee camps in Kurdistan. Washington has asked European countries to supply arms and ammunition to the Kurdish forces who are fighting the jihadists. There are reports of heavy shelling in the rebel-held Ukrainian city of Donetsk. People have been seen leaving the center after an evacuation warning sounded. Donetsk has been surrounded by government troops for weeks as they try to regain control of the area from pro-Russian separatists. Nigeria has confirmed 11 cases of Ebola after a doctor who treated a Liberian man who brought the disease to Lagos fell ill. There have now been three fatalities in Nigeria. More than 1,000 people have died in four West African nations in the recent outbreak. Guinea has declared a national health emergency. A new five-day truce between Israel and Hamas appears to be holding after both sides agreed to give Egyptian-brokered peace talks in Cairo more time to try to end the Gaza war. The Israeli military said Gaza militants had breached the truce by firing eight rockets at Israel shortly after midnight. In response, Israeli fighter planes targeted rocket launches and terror sites across the Gaza Strip. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has visited Israel and met with officials, including the former president, Shimon Peres. Earlier, the two men visited the site of what the Israelis say was one of the smuggling tunnels used by Hamas militants.
It's always a new level of attack, and there's always another technology, there's always another adaptation. The enemy is not giving up.
North Korea has fired three short-range rockets off its east coast. The South Korean Defense Ministry says the rockets were fired from multiple launches in the North Korean port city of Wonsan. The event happened just before Pope Francis arrived in Seoul on his first visit to Asia. Speaking there, he praised efforts to bring peace to the peninsula.
Korea's quest for peace is a cause close to our hearts, for it affects the stability of the entire area at indeed of our whole war-weary world.
Pope Francis speaking in the South Korean capital, Seoul. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. We'll get more news in 25 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06 and it is 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are Mary Dichevsky, columnist with The Independent, and Daniela Pellet, editor at Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. At least one person has died today in heavy shelling in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk. The fighting took place as a Russian aid convoy snaked its way closer to the border. President Putin says that more than 260 lorries are filled with humanitarian aid, but skeptics are claiming that they are just a front for his real plan, which is to launch an invasion. Mary, if I start with you, the reports coming out of Donetsk today, they are pretty grim. These people over there are going to need this kind of humanitarian aid, aren't they?
Yes, and it's not just Donetsk. Donetsk is the biggest place. It's the biggest city, actually, in eastern Ukraine, with more than a million population. The city of Luhansk, which is second only to Donetsk in the region, half the population there is said to have fled. The other half are said to have been without electricity and without water for more than 2 weeks. So there is obviously, there's a serious need and urgent need for all sorts of aid all over eastern Ukraine.
Well, Ukraine has said that the Russian aid convoy won't be able to enter the country before it has been inspected by international monitors. Daniela, do you think this could happen?
Well, the ICRC is in the process of doing some sort of negotiations here and there. But I mean, this isn't clearly about the aid, even as much as the aid is needed. It's an immensely political move. And from talking to people in Kiev in the last couple of days, it seems opinion is kind of split 50-50. Some people think it's a ruse to smuggle in weapons to the insurgents, and other people think that it's a PR stunt or an attempt to try and provoke the Kiev government into acting. And the Kiev government looks very bad now, because the people are saying, how can you just put up with this? Why don't you do something? But of course, doing something here is not so easy.
So what do you think Putin has been thinking over here? What if this aid convoy actually is all about just offering humanitarian help, and that there is indeed something that's really needed inside those trucks?
Well, I'm sure that this is something exactly what most Russians think, and they feel extremely hard done by. They feel that everything they do, even when they try to do the right thing, that they're deeply suspect by the West, and they think this is hugely unjustified. And they look at other places in the world and they say, you know, anybody can send aid convoys and they get some credit for it. And the moment Russia decides to send an aid convoy, then it's told, oh, it's trying to send troops or weapons in a sort of Trojan horse operation. So I think they feel deeply hard done by. But also, I think it's quite interesting that in the last 24 hours, the authorities in Kiev have mounted a little operation of their own, a little aid operation. So now there are two convoys snaking around in the region, one of them sort of hovering on the Russian side of the Ukrainian border, and the other trying to get into eastern Ukraine, which they have no control of.
What is interesting, there's been a few reports by a few journalists who've actually had a chance of looking into some of these lorries, and they say they actually are full of things such as sleeping bags, baby food, and so forth. We're not actually worried that they've also got weapons in them, are we?
I really don't know. I've got no way of knowing. But I think sending aid, as I said earlier, is hugely political. In the same way that I'm sure we're going to be talking about Gaza later, but in the same way that the repeated Gaza flotillas coming from Turkey and so on, supposedly loaded with humanitarian aid, have been seen by Israel and others in the West as an immensely political statement. I mean, this is the same thing here, and it's a huge challenge to Ukrainian sovereignty.
And looking at the Russians, they don't have a great track record in these kind of things, do they?
No, well, that's another problem, of course. And, you know, if it is a sort of precedent of Russia trying to do the right thing on the aid front and mount this huge operation, you know, then that's one thing. And the other thing is if they're using it either for practical purposes to shore up the troops in the east, or if they are using it inevitably as a PR exercise to say, look, we're doing the right thing and we're sending in aid, and the authorities in Kiev, who are supposed to be in charge of this country, can't actually do it.
So Mary, what do you think? I'm thinking about Putin again, and I'm thinking about what he's been planning, and it seems very clever at the moment, sending this kind of an aid convoy, being basically absolutely sure there is no way it's going to get across the border straight away.
Yes, I mean, I think that there seem to have been several phases to this operation. They started out, it appears, with some sort of draft agreement to be able to cross the border in a place which was controlled by Kiev. Then that agreement seems to have broken down, and so they're snaking around the border to get to a border point where the forces friendly to them control the territory. But it also seems, I mean, as Daniela was saying, that there is a sort of maybe everybody's actually hesitating and trying to delay in the hope of a better agreement overseen by the International Red Cross. And of course, that would be the ideal arrangement. If Russia's convoy was actually aid, if it was verified by the Red Cross, if the Kiev authorities could give their say-so to crossing the border, then, you know, the world might look slightly better tomorrow.
I think the current crisis, as Mary says, that there is a genuine humanitarian crisis there. It's also a sign, the flip side perhaps, of the Ukrainian success in pushing back the separatists. Because you've seen scenes of fighting, of urban warfare, shelling in built-up areas. I think the death toll has nearly doubled in the last few weeks. And that's an inevitable, that's what happens. If you bring the fight to an urban area, that is what's going to happen. People without services, people, civilians are dying. I mean, there's no way of knowing now how many civilians have been killed and how many fighters. But that's the flip side of the pushback. And it's hard to tell how long this can go on, how long they can push their advantage and what the civilian casualties will be.
Also, the European Commission has been meeting in Brussels today to discuss the impact of Russian sanctions on member states. What is your impression? What is likely to come out of all that?
Well, probably not a lot, because it does seem as though the European Union has been a bit wrong-footed by Russia's retaliatory sanctions, that it believed that it was being quite clever and refined and being smart about sanctions on specific Russians and then on specific areas of the economy. And then when Putin turned round and at quite a late stage said, OK, right, we're going to ban imports of food from the EU. I mean, this puts huge pressure on those countries, especially southern European countries, whose economies are not in the best shape anyway, who have large contracts for fruit, vegetables and meat with Russia. And Russia can replace those from other parts of the world, but southern Europe can't replace customers so fast within the season.
Moving forward, the United Nations has declared the crisis in Iraq an emergency of the highest level 3, which means it now has the power to allocate extra funding to deal with the situation. The UN stressed that the advance of Islamic State militants in the north of the country has left tens of thousands of people displaced on Mount Sinjar in a critical condition. This announcement came as the United States said its findings showed that there were actually fewer people stranded on Mount Sinjar as it had previously estimated, and that those who are still there have got water and food. The White House has now decided not to carry out an evacuation mission. There's a funny impression now that it seems that the UN and the US are disagreeing on what actually is going on over there.
I think it's very difficult to get an accurate picture. You know, it's an immense crisis on an immense scale in this very remote and arid mountain range. Huge disruption to life. And there's already an enormous exchange of population exchange and population search there. And the numbers, I spoke to Yazidi diplomat on late Tuesday night, and the numbers he was giving me of how many people were in Mount Sinjar, how many refugees were here and there were enormous. I mean, they seem to be exaggerated. But at the same time, I can't really see how it's possible to get completely accurate numbers on that. But he certainly said to me, which I don't think was reported at that point, that the first humanitarian aid drops had made a difference and really significantly eased conditions there. I mean, it wasn't a long-term solution, but he said, yeah, that was now. Well, as soon as the food and water was there, then the priorities moved on to look at other parts of the Yazidi community suffering trouble from ISIS.
Well, critics have already said that the numbers of trapped refugees should be no excuse for the US to step back. These critics are saying that these refugees should be rescued from this place, whether there were 5,000 or 50,000 of them. Do you agree with them, Mary?
I understand the ethical principle that says that any life is a life worth saving and that it really doesn't matter whether there's 5, 50, 500, 500,000. But I do think that when it comes to your troops and your military effort, which is what America is actually about over this, then it does matter how many. And so I think that the disparity that there's been, especially in the last 24 hours, as to whether there are, as the Americans say, well, actually, most people are doing okay and most people have already escaped. And the people who say, well, there could be as many as 300,000 still in need of help. I think that you have to take it from the Americans and their judgment as to weighing up the interests of the people that they're talking about saving and their own national interests. I mean, I think that is an equation that you have to consider as a national government.
Daniela.
I think the other question to ask is, well, where are these people going to go? There's already a refugee crisis in the region. Erbil has seen thousands and thousands of Iraqi Christians fleeing there. Dohuk has got enormous amounts of Yazidi as well. And from talking to Yazidi, they say that they're so frightened. They think that their future in Iraq is very bleak, if not over. So where are they going to go? And where, if we're going to, it's not a question of rescue them from a mountain and putting them somewhere safe. Where is safe and where is going to be safe? A lot of them want Europe to accept refugees. And others say, well, we want the Peshmerga to be armed and we want some arms as well to defend ourselves. I think just taking them off the mountain is nowhere near enough anyway finding a solution.
And on the other hand, when you're talking about where these people should be taken to, is there a chance that all this is just going to lead to a different crisis, a refugee crisis? We've seen in Jordan, for example, that how overwhelmed with Syrians they were.
Yes, I mean, I think this is a gigantic problem. It's a problem in Jordan. It's an even bigger problem proportionately in Lebanon. And potentially it's a gigantic problem for the Kurdish areas of Iraq because they have been aspiring to full autonomy, if not complete independence as a state. And the influx of a lot of people that they need to look after and they need to pay to look after, they need to accommodate, it has a destabilizing effect. And I don't think we can, you know, we know from Western countries that a large number of refugees, and when we talk about a large number of refugees, it is nothing compared with the numbers that these countries are having to deal with.
As I mentioned in the beginning, the United Nations has now declared the crisis in Iraq an emergency of the highest level, level 3. And this declaration makes it easier to divert funds to deal with this crisis. What do you expect this to actually mean, practically speaking?
Well, I mean, the problem is it is a humanitarian crisis. It's become a humanitarian crisis, but it's actually a war. It's set as a war. It's several wars. No amount of food, no amount of aid, Doctors Without Borders, none of this is going to deal with any of the core reasons. And I'm among one of those who perhaps unfashionably, although it comes in and out of fashion, thought that the West should have intervened in Syria a long time ago. Then I went through a phase of thinking, well, it was too late. And now I think it's not too late again. Because what we're facing, and the more I speak to people on the ground, the worse the picture emerges. And ISIS are very, very well armed. They're cutting a swathe through Iraq and Syria. And the West doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. This whole prophecy that Assad was touting, that the idea that the rebels were all radical Islamists, seems to have come true, and we've left it incredibly late to do anything about it. But humanitarian aid, again, like the airlifts from the mountain, is not the answer.
I suppose I've moved in a slightly opposite direction, in that I am fervently against intervention in other people's disputes, including on when there is a humanitarian pretext. I think that the intervention, including in Libya, was extremely ill-advised and destabilizing. I think these are wars that are being fought internally, and we create a false balance that there wasn't before, and that people who live there actually have to live with the consequences. But after the Americans, on Obama's orders, conducted aerial bombardments in northern Iraq in order to create a safe corridor for the refugees to escape from the mountains, then I thought, well, yes, maybe this is how the responsibility to protect really should work. Maybe there is a justification for this. So in a way, I've moved in the opposite direction.
Let's leave Iraq now. Let's move to Syria. It's just been announced that most of the chemical weapons seized in Syria have been destroyed. A chemical weapons watchdog says workers on board a US government ship have neutralized 581 metric tons of the substance used to make sarin. There are still around 20 tons of the blistering agent sulfur mustard. And once that has been done, all of the chemical weapons removed from the country will have been made useless. More than 1,000 people were killed in a sarin attack near Damascus last summer, after which the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad was forced by the US to give up his chemical weapons. Well, chlorine was not included on the list of banned substances, although the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says that there is evidence it has been used in a systematic manner. Mary, if I start with you, how much of a success can this destruction of chemical weapons be seen as if Assad still has access to another lethal substance?
Well, I understand that it would be seen as only a partial success if another substance remains. But I would be a bit more positive about it, because I think that when the operation was first mooted, there was a huge amount of scepticism about whether it was even possible to start because of the contested power in all sorts of regions of Syria. It was said that it would be totally impossible. It was a non-starter. And we're now looking at it a year later, and to my mind, this is actually quite a success amid all the bleak news elsewhere.
Daniela, as these substances have all been removed now, but the war continues to rage in Syria, is this discussion significant about chemical weapons at the moment?
I think it's significant for Assad, because he's scoring some PR points there. I mean, I agree that I'm very glad that something was done and that the international community for once seemed to speak out, and because I think chemical weapons, it is a red line. But it hasn't stopped the government in Damascus killing many, many more people and using chlorine and so on and so forth. And it wasn't a dramatic enough move by the international community that seems to have checked any ambitions on the ground. So now Syria can say, right, we've given up our chemical weapons. You see, we're law-abiding, we're complying with international law. But how much that affects the situation on the ground doesn't seem to have a great deal of effect.
Let's continue with a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marko Sippi, Mary Dzhevsky and Daniela Pellet. When we return, we'll discuss the extension of the ceasefire on the Gaza Strip.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 21:25 in Moscow, 18:25 in London and 13:25 in New York City. Still with me are Mary Dachevsky and Daniela Pellet. Gazans woke up this morning to the news that Hamas and the Israelis have agreed to extend a ceasefire in the Strip for another 5 days, raising fresh hope that these two sides are coming closer to reaching an agreement on ending the month-long conflict. A senior Hamas official has said there is now a real opportunity to strike a deal, but has stressed the group won't sign anything that doesn't achieve what the people of Gaza want. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians have been killed in the latest Gaza war. The United Nations estimates nearly three quarters were civilians, and more than 60 Israelis have also died. Daniela Pellet, how much hope should we take from the extension of the ceasefire?
I'm not sure applying the word hope to the situation is particularly relevant. I mean, anything that stops active hostilities is great, but we've had a ceasefire before. I mean, most recently there was an 18-month ceasefire that Hamas stuck to fairly strictly, really, preventing not only its own forces from firing rockets, but other Islamic Jihad and other small splinter groups, even putting people in the cells for a night or two. They acted as Israel's policemen. It was quiet for a year and a half. Then this latest round of violence started. So when we talk about an agreement, we talk about a short-term, temporary agreement, not in any way anything like a roadmap for the future or any agreement on borders or freedom of access. Hamas demanding a Gaza port, an international airport. I mean, this seems like pie in the sky.
Daniela, if I continue with you, there have also been reports that this ceasefire has already been broken. There are reports of Palestinian rocket fire and Israeli retaliatory airstrikes. What is your impression of the current situation?
Well, that's the problem. To enforce a ceasefire has to be enforced. As I said before, Hamas was enforcing it on the ground. I mean, it's very difficult for it to do so now, partly because there's an immense system of chaos there. And also because, yeah, Islamic Jihad are not, they're part of the ceasefire talks, but they're not interested necessarily in the same aims that Hamas are. I think what's very interesting now about the ceasefire talks is looking at the role that Egypt is going to play, because clearly no friend of the Hamas government. And what could help a future ceasefire, a future cessation of violence, is it an agreement on the Rafah crossing?
Mary, the Palestinian side wants the blockade on Gaza to be lifted. That's what people on the Gaza Strip want. Israel wants the territory to be fully disarmed. First of all, can you see a solution that would even somewhat satisfy the both sides and the wishes for ending the blockade on Gaza? Is that realistic at all?
Well, it seems actually quite unrealistic, because what each side wants is exclusive. It's impossible to satisfy both sides at the same time with what they're both demanding. And in some ways, I think things have been made a bit worse, because if Israel is correct in saying that it ended its operation because it had sealed or destroyed all the tunnels in and out of Gaza, then there is no sort of there's now no sort of relief mechanism inside Gaza to relieve the situation in any way. The tunnels were there for a purpose, because there was a blockade, and to an extent it calmed things down until they erupted again. And it doesn't seem to me that the discussions currently going on are going to produce an agreement which is going to last. It may keep a ceasefire for a little while, but we're back in the same situation that we've been time and time again.
Daniel, do you agree?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between the two very different types of tunnels. And there was the 1,200 or so tunnels coming from under the Rafah border from Egypt, which operated, and Mary's completely right, as Israel accused it being a conduit for arms, but more importantly, it was a conduit for absolutely everything else, from petrol to nappies to cement. I mean, that is how Gaza economy functions. Also how Hamas functioned, because they levied enormous taxes on it, and that was a big source of their funding. Now, with a new the newish regime in Egypt closed down all of those tunnels a year ago. And that is what has really, really bit very hard into the Gaza economy and the situation of the people there. The tunnels that Israel destroyed are what Israel likes to call the terror tunnels, dramatically enough. And these are tunnels coming, burrowing over, under the border into Israel proper. Now, these are a symbol of Hamas's, you know, strategic ability to go in, kidnap a soldier or kidnap an Israeli or carry out a terror attack. But it's not part of the solution.
We'll have to leave it there now. Thank you very much, Mary Dichevsky and Daniela Pellet, for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
On the second half of today's edition of Midori House, we'll get the biggest discussion topics from Milan. We'll find out about the radio station that is hoping to get huge numbers of baby listeners. And Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound will give us his three book recommendations. But before we get started on that, here is Suzanne Gislett with the world news headlines.
Thank you, Marcus. President Obama has called off a mission to rescue thousands of Yazidi Christians from a mountain in northern Iraq after American forces discovered most had managed to escape themselves. Tens of thousands of people had fled from advancing Islamic State extremists. Many are now in Kurdistan, where the UN's described the situation as a humanitarian emergency. There are reports of heavy shelling in the rebel-held Ukrainian city of Donetsk. It's been surrounded by government forces for weeks as they try to regain control of the area from pro-Russian rebels. Guinea has declared a national health emergency as it tries to halt the spread of the potentially fatal Ebola virus. The World Health Organization says more than 1,000 people have died after contracting the disease in West Africa. And a new five-day truce between Israel and Hamas appears to be holding in Gaza. Both sides have agreed to give Egyptian brokered peace talks in Cairo more time to try to end the conflict. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. That was Suzanne Gislett. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow. It is 18:33 here in London and 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Milan, where Monocle's Tom Lewis spoke earlier to Ivan Carvalho, who began by discussing the spat that's brewing between Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and Mario Draghi of the European Central Bank.
The two of them really don't see eye to eye at this point in terms of the priorities of where Italy should be dedicating its energies in terms of the government on reforms. Matteo Renzi has made a victory of sorts, passing a bill in the Senate to reform the Senate, sort of cut down the size of government in Italy. And that's seen as a positive, but people are wondering whether his priorities are in the right place. And Mario Draghi, who is, of course, the former Bank of Italy governor now at the ECB in Frankfurt, is saying that, look, the real structural reforms on the labor market and making business easier to do in Italy is something that still Renzi hasn't grappled head on. And it's something that Mario Draghi has said in the past, and I've mentioned it in the past as well, on this program, that these key structural reforms, labor market reform, ways to get business done quicker in Italy. I mean, it takes, just for example, almost 1,200 days to get a contract dispute resolved. And if you're a foreign company, you don't want to deal with that. You have to deal with a ever faster moving market in the world, and you don't want to be bogged down in an Italian court. And so Draghi was sort of saying this to people in London and in Brussels that, look, I've been saying this in the past, that these structural reforms are key and need to be done. And he met privately with Renzi just the other day, and reports came out about this meeting in Italy, where Renzi flew up from Rome on by helicopter to meet Draghi at his summer residence. And so there's talk about, you know, who's dictating here. Renzi has been saying to the press that, look, the Troika will not dictate. I will dictate where the reforms are going to be happening and how they're going to be happening. So it's going to be quite interesting to see the next set of reforms package that Renzi brings out and where he's going to prioritize.
And do you think that, say, the public reaction or the coverage of this in the press might make Matteo Renzi feel as though he should make this a priority rather than other political reforms that he's focused on?
Yeah, I believe so, because there's a lot of frustration, obviously. Italy has returned to recession. This is now the third recession in just a handful of years. And also, the unemployment rate is still quite high. And so I believe that he needs to. I mean, he's a bit of a micromanager. That's also his problem. He wanted to do 100 days reform to tackle various sectors of the Italian economy and society. But he's now saying he's going to need 1,000 days. I think he needs to really recalibrate and look at where the priorities are, because, you know, red tape and labor market reform are things that businesses in Italy have been begging for. And, you know, Mario Draghi is not going to be giving cheap credit out just tomorrow unless these key reforms are happening. And Renzi's asking for more flexibility from Brussels during dealing with the budget. But we'll have to see how this game plays out in the coming months.
And another game that we'll have to see play out, Ivan, is the effect of the sanctions announced by President Vladimir Putin against EU nations as a retaliation for the sanctions placed upon it following the downing of flight MH17. This too is getting a lot of coverage in Italy. What are the major fallouts for Italy from these sanctions imposed by Moscow?
Well, we have the ban on food imports, which obviously Italy, being a key producer of everything from fine wine to pasta and prosciutto, that's somewhere in the order of the Farmers Association say that could be 800 million euros that could be in lost business. And curiously now with the summer season, there are reports in lots of resorts, for example, in Sardinia, in the Costa Smeralda, where a place where Putin was once a guest of former Prime Minister Berlusconi, that lots of Russian oligarchs and even Putin's sister have been showing up at hotels this year or at their summer homes and aren't spending money. Perhaps Putin has been asking them to stay away and stay in Russia during the current crisis. And even businesses, for example, there was the fashion designer Roberto Cavalli, famous for his flamboyant leopard prints. There's a Russian bank that wants to possibly buy his company, but you know they're on the sanctions. So all these things are causing problems for an Italian economy, which, you know, really is desperate for doing business, and this is not going to help them.
And is there any sense that the government in Rome might change its stance, therefore, if these things do start to bite on, as you say, an already struggling economy?
Well, you know, it is difficult. Italy's foreign minister, for example, was recently criticized for being too close to Moscow. And she was actually up for the post of, you know, EU foreign policy chief. But that doesn't look like it's going to be happening at the end of this month. Italy, of course, has long ties. I mean, that's also because of Berlusconi and his relationship with Putin in the past. There is a South Stream, you know, pipeline project that's going to bypass Ukraine. And Italian companies are involved in that. And so the Ukraine situation is not something that's doing a lot for Italy's image right now on both ends, you know, in terms of the politicians and also for its businesses. So it's a thorny issue. And of course, it's going to be resolved at higher levels at this point, EU and Washington and so on.
And another thorny issue from Italy's tourist market is the presence of cruise liners in Venice. We've covered this story that they may be a sight that we will see no longer in Venice. How is this playing out, would you say?
Well, you know, this comes on the recent, you know, Costa Concordia tragedy. And just the other day, I happened to see the Concordia ship laid up in the port here in Genoa. It's become a sort of macabre tourist site. And that's that memory of that accident, that it could happen again, you know, maybe a malfunction or something in the canal in Venice, a UNESCO heritage site with, you know, thousands of art treasures and historic buildings, that if something were to go wrong with these massive ships that are over, the ban is actually targeting ships the size of Concordia, so over 100,000 tons. But even others are saying that there should be a wider ban put in place, because the reverberations that in the water with these massive ships, their displacement in the water, on the foundations of Venice, that there needs to be created quickly, and obviously the Cruise Industry Association wants to happen very soon, an alternative port nearby where they can offload passengers, because we're talking about 2 million passengers a year, which bring in half a billion euros just from the cruise industry. And so, I mean, it's a delicate situation, which Venice needs the money, but at the same time, it needs to preserve its historic buildings.
That was Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo speaking to our Thomas Lewis. Up next, we'll speak to the founder of a radio station with a very well-defined target group, that is babies. Stay tuned to find out more.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Now, for parents who are bored of baby talk, there is a new way to turn on and tune out. French actor Julia Borchet has developed a child-friendly radio station. It's called Radio Doudou. The 24-hour stream features a broad range of tunes, from lullabies and nursery rhymes to plenty of stuff the parents can enjoy too. Earlier, I asked Julian how he came up with this idea.
My personal experience is that I have three children, and I always wanted to hear music with them, good music. And when I look around and buy CDs with children music, it was always the same music, the same songs, and oftenly it was not really a good music. It was like artificial music. You see what I mean? I really wanted to hear good music with them.
What sort of music is it then that then you are playing? What is that music that both the babies and their parents like?
Well, the babies, I think, can appreciate any kind of music. That was my thought at the beginning. So I play children music as lullabies and children songs. But it's not even half of the music we played. We play anything that we think babies will like. It can be any kind of style, like classical music. We play a lot of classical music, a lot of jazz, because in the jazz we find really beautiful harmonies and beautiful voice. We think that babies do really appreciate beautiful voices. And even pop and rock music, if the music is really cool, or sometimes we play children version of very famous pop rock songs.
Julian, on your website, people can go and check the most played songs of the moment. And let's hear a bit of the song that is the number one at the moment.
Une chanson douce que me chantait ma maman. En suçant mon pouce, j'écoutais en m'endormant. Cette chanson douce, je veux la chanter pour toi.
That was Une Chanson Douce by Henry Salvador. Julian, why is this song so popular at the moment?
I must say that it is a surprise for me, because this song is not really a children's song at the beginning. But the fact is that the grandparents, the parents and the babies like this song. I think this is something special with this song. It is really intergenerational. It's fun because this song is always on the top like of the radio.
Le loup on s'en fiche, contre lui nous serons deux.
Do you change the music throughout the day? Do the songs become a bit more soothing in the evening when a lot of babies are being put to bed.
Yes, sure. And even in the afternoon, we have 2 hours of cooler music. And at night, we begin at 7, 7:30, a lullaby broadcasting. In a few weeks, we will have 2 streamings, one very normal and one very cool, always lullaby
music. Julien, what kind of music would you never play to babies?
I think that in every kind of styles, we have music that will not be appreciated by babies. Mostly, I will not play music that you will hear on hit radios, because I think if parents want to hear this music with their babies, it's okay, but they can do it easily, and babies are in contact with this hit music all day long, but I think this is not the best music for them. So I work with all the other styles, the styles you don't hear every day on popular radios, even if I love this music too.
And is all the music in French?
Oh no, the idea is to broadcast French music because it is a first contact with language for French native languages babies, but it is also a way to discover all kind of languages. In fact, we have over 20 languages broadcasted on Radio Dudu, Portuguese, Russian. We have songs from India. We also play a lot of songs with no words to hear really music and orchestration and melodies.
Let's listen to one of your songs in English. This is Otis Redding with I've Been Loving You Too Long. What do you say to those people who are wondering if this kind of radio station is just a way for parents to interact less with their children?
To interact less? Oh no, I would say it's a way to interact more with the children, because the goal of this kind of radio is to be a media to have a moment together around with the music. I have many messages from people listening to the radio. I know they listen to the radio with the baby.
And your love is growing cold. So that song was Otis Redding with I've Been Loving You For Too Long, a song you can hear on Radio Dudu. And before that, I spoke to Julien Bochet, who is the founder of this radio station. You're listening to Midori House. Frankly, it would be wrong of me not to continue with a bit more music and to pick the obvious choice to follow that last interview. Here is Freddie Mercury and Queen with, you guessed it, Radio Gaga. That was Freddie Mercury and Queen with Radio Gaga. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it is time now to review the best and sometimes worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books and more. And today we talk books. Joining me in the studio is the one and only Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, with his book recommendations. Hello, Rob, how are you doing?
Marcus, thanks for having me. This is the first time we've been on the radio together since you got back from New York. Your voice gets sexier.
Do you think so?
Yeah, this has got nothing to do with any of the novels and memoirs we're going to talk about today. It's just a matter of fact for our listeners.
Do you think it's my newly found American accent?
Yeah, I do. You've gone really transatlantic. You sound like a DJ from the 1980s. Kid Jensen, are you familiar with Kid Jensen?
Yeah, I know the name.
Google him, listeners.
Awesome. But hey, it's time for books indeed. And the first book you have for today is The Dog by Joseph O'Neill.
Yeah, this is a fantastic book. I think it came out last week. Joseph O'Neill is an Irish-American writer. He's based in New York. His last book was called Netherland, and it was about an unlikely thing where a Dutch banker got into playing cricket in New York. So he writes these tales of sort of dislocation, people that aren't in their homeland doing something that might not be necessarily familiar to them. His new book is called The Dog, and it's set in Dubai, which I always thought would be the city that if J.G. Ballard had lived to write another novel, he would have set his last novel in Dubai. And it is obviously such a rich place for a very strange novel of dislocation. This novel has been called a sort of post-colonial novel in a weird sense. And it's an amazing thing. Again, this guy, he's an American guy who goes over to do a job in Dubai that is essentially sort of keeping his eye on a few emails and doing absolutely nothing for a very rich family, a very rich Lebanese family that have their sort of headquarters for tax reasons in Dubai. And he kind of has a non-job, and he sort of has non-affairs with people, and he has sort of non-friendships with people. And it is this sort of strange nullity. And in terms of the writing of it, it's sort of hilariously pitched somewhere between kind of Douglas Copeland and I guess sort of almost, there's a bit of American Psycho in there as well. It's a really unusual, hilarious, and sort of worryingly prescient novel, I think.
It sounds like you did have a great time reading it.
Yeah, it's absolutely hilarious. I mean, it's probably, I hate to use the phrase laugh out loud, fine, but it's nice when people on the bus turn their, have to rubber neck to see where the gigglings come from.
What about your second book for today? It's called Age is for Hawk, is by Helen MacDonald, And what I've heard, it's basically a book about training a hawk.
It is. It's a really unusual book, this. Helen MacDonald, she's an author and she's a poet and she's an academic at Cambridge University. And she grew up kind of having it as a sort of hobby, doing a bit of falconry and stuff. I think she grew up in the countryside and sort of did a bit of this as a hobby. In this book, which is a memoir, it's an interestingly written memoir. Her father dies, and to get over her death, she sort of takes on this huge responsibility of training not just any hawk, but a goshawk, which is sort of this legendarily naughty hawk. I mean, they're very wild. They're very wild, and they go even if you tame one. If you don't see it for a week, it'll go completely wild again. So it's this kind of struggle about sort of woman and beast, and it's an amazing sort of struggle of wills that she obviously feels that she needs to sort of get over the death of her father. And it's an amazing thing where she becomes sort of one with this bird. It's where the animal and the human sort of balance each other out, and there's a sort of interesting fulcrum of she becomes the bird and the bird becomes human and all the rest of it. It's fascinating.
That sounds really
such an unusual book.
Exactly. Amazing. I was just going to ask, it sounds so unique. Has anyone ever done anything like this? Can you compare this book to anything else anyone has ever released?
Well, it's a good question. There's an unusual rich seam of books about falconry. I mean, it was a sport of the Lords of the Manor of the sort of 16th, 17th, 18th century. It's obviously a huge Arabian sport. It's the sport of kings for the Arabs. But interestingly, there's a book called The Goshawk by T.H. White, who wrote The Sword in the Stone and things under a pseudonym. And he, again, sort of had a battle of wills with this goshawk and wrote about it. And there's a very close reading of that book woven through Helen MacDonald's book, H is for Hawk. So there are these two sort of stories woven together and running side by side through this thing. And it's such an unusual book, and I would urge anyone to read it because it's absolutely fascinating. It's very moving and beautiful.
I know it's a memoir. I'm still wondering if in the end of the book, Helen just simply gets rid of that hawk.
Well, it's not going to be any sort of plot spoilers.
Exactly.
A lot of chicks are harmed in the making of this book.
One more book, one more recommendation from Europe for today. It's called A Guide for the Perplexed. It's by Werner Herzog, German award-winning director. In this book, he basically talks about his successful career. Do you learn anything new about him when you read this?
You do. I mean, it's a 600-page book. It's conversations between Werner Herzog and Paul Cronin, who is not so much a film critic as a Werner Herzog fan. And it's this interesting, strange thing where they really get under each other's skin. And I actually spoke to Paul and Werner Herzog a few days ago. I've interviewed them for the magazine about putting this book together, and it was a sort of that again. I mean, talking about H is for Hawk and kind of training an unruly wild animal. You sometimes get the idea that any writer trying to tie down the working practice of Werner Herzog is doing a similar thing to training an eagle and getting them to land on their fist. It's a really hilarious thing. Werner Herzog, obviously, an amazing career and a career kind of defined by working outside of the regular rules of the European film industry and of Hollywood and all the rest of it. And his great, he feels that his great gift is simply perseverance. He was a man who, after all, walked from England to Germany in order that he thought he would save someone's life if he went through a similar hardship to them, as is documented in his book Walking on Thin Ice. And there's a similar element to that in this book, that crazy perseverance that sets Werner Herzog apart. I mean, carrying the ship up the mountain in Fitzcarraldo and all these sorts of things, working with Klaus, the mad Klaus Kinski, and all these sorts of things. It's very funny and it's really insightful, and it is a sort of guide.
It sounds amazing. Do you think, what's your impression of Werner Herzog basing on this book? How much is he willing to open up and tell about those stories? Or is there still more to be discovered about his life?
I think this, actually, he regards this as the document. I mean, he said, every morning when I wake up and I shoot a roll of film, you know, the book becomes obsolete, is what he said a couple of days ago when I spoke to him about it. But it is, I would have said, so far, the definitive article on this great man's career.
That book was A Guide for the Perplexed by Werner Herzog. And telling about this book was Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound. Thank you very much, Rob.
Thanks, Marcus.
And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Mary Dijewski and Daniela Pellet. Today's show was produced by Marika Peters, researched by David Blessant and Aaron Duffy, and our studio manager was Chris Gilvers. Next after the headlines is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and don't forget The Monocle Daily in 3 hours' time. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, that is at 1300 hours in New York. For this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.